Messiah sent to the Jewish people, in fulfillment of the plans of the Jewish God as set forth, Paul came to realize in the Jewish scriptures. But the message was not only for Jews, it was for all people, Jew and Gentile. And it came to Gentiles apart from observing the Jewish law. Thus, to become members of God's covenantal people, it was not necessary for Gentiles to become Jews. They did not need to be circumcised, observe the Sabbath, keep kosher, or follow any of the other prescriptions of the law. They needed only to believe in the death and resurrection of the Messiah Jesus. This was an earth-shattering realization for Paul. Prior to this, the followers of Jesus, the first Christians, were of course Jews, who understood that he was the Messiah who had died and been raised from the dead. But they knew this as the act of the Jewish God given to his people, the Jews. Certainly Gentiles could find this salvation as well, but first they had to be Jewish. Not for Paul. Jew or Gentile, it did not matter. What mattered was faith in Christ. Once Paul came to realize this, he was blinded yet again by a further insight. Throughout the prophets of Scripture can be found predictions that at the end of time God would bring outsiders into the fold of the people of God as Gentiles flock to the good news that comes forth from his chosen ones, the message delivered through his Jewish people. The prophet Isaiah had said, "In days to come the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths.' For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. The prophecy of Isaiah was coming true in Paul's own day. Or consider the words of the prophet Zechariah. "Many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem. In those days 10 people from nations of every language shall take hold of a Jew, grasping his garment and saying, 'Let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" Zechariah chapter 8, verses 22 and 23. God had predicted that Gentiles would come to the salvation that transpired in Jerusalem. Where had Jesus been killed? Jerusalem. How was the message to go forth? It would be preached by Jews, or a Jew, to outsiders. Paul may well have thought specifically of famous words about God's special servant, spoken by the Lord himself, again in the book of Isaiah. "I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I have taken you by the hand and kept you. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison those who sit in darkness. I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." Isaiah chapter 42, verses 6 and 7, chapter 49, verse 6. Who is this one who was called in righteousness to preach God's salvation as a light to the nations? Remember how Paul describes his conversion experience in Galatians 1? "God called me through his grace and in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles." Galatians chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. Paul was the one God had called to take his message of salvation afield. Paul's calling to preach was anticipated in the Jewish scriptures. Paul himself was the fulfillment of prophecy. He was the one God had chosen to bring salvation to the world through his proclamation of Jesus' death and resurrection. A number of scholars over the years have suggested that, rather than speaking of Paul's conversion, we should instead speak of his call. Part of the logic behind this suggestion is that it is misguided to think Paul left one religion, Judaism, in order to adopt another, Christianity. It is widely acknowledged among Pauline scholars today that this is absolutely right. As Paul's recent biographer, J. Albert Harrell, has expressed it, "Paul thus did not change from Judaism to Christianity in the sense of a faith apart from the religion of Israel." In other words, Paul did not see himself as switching religions. He came to realize that Christ was the fulfillment of Judaism, of everything that God had planned and revealed within the sacred Jewish scriptures. God had not abandoned the Jews or vacated the Jewish religion. Christ himself had not opposed the Jewish faith or proposed to start something new. Christ stood in absolute continuity with all that went before. But for Paul, without Christ, the Jewish faith was incomplete and imperfect. Christ was the goal to which that faith had long striven, and now he had arrived, and Paul was his prophet. Even while granting that Paul saw himself principally as one who was called, we should not jettison too quickly the term conversion for what he experienced. True, in his own eyes, he did not stop being a Jew, or think he was preaching a message at odds with Judaism. But he did turn around, the literal meaning of conversion, making a radical change in his understanding of that religion and, even more obviously, in his understanding of Christ, rejecting his earlier view of Jesus as condemned by God and coming to see him as God's Messiah. And so, possibly, it is best to consider his experience as both a call and a conversion. Whatever terms we use, it was a cataclysmic change, astounding in its heightened self-understanding. God had commissioned Paul to take this gospel message to the Gentiles. For Paul, this was not merely an interesting career choice. It was the completion of God's plan for the human race. Paul's mission had been predicted by the prophets of old in anticipation of the coming kingdom of God. Paul was to bring the history of the world to its preordained climax. Paul's missionary strategy. The received wisdom that Paul engaged in, three missionary journeys, derives from the accounts in the book of Acts. The final two-thirds of the book, chapters 13 to 28, are principally devoted to these journeys and the arrest and trials of Paul that came in their wake. In his own writings, Paul never mentions a specific number of missionary endeavors, but at one point he does intimate a missionary strategy. In what was probably the last of his surviving letters and the only one addressed to a church that, by his own admission, he did not found, the letter to the Romans, he looks back on the missionary work already done. "I have completed my preaching of the gospel of Christ from Jerusalem to Illyricum." Romans chapter 15, verse 19. Here Paul is sketching an arc of missionary proclamation from the capital of Judea to the northwestern Balkans. As it turns out, nowhere in his letters does Paul indicate that he spent time in Jerusalem trying to convert anyone. On the contrary, he makes it quite clear that he understood himself to be the missionary to the Gentiles, leaving the Jewish mission to the disciple Peter and others. Galatians chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. We also have no record of him taking his mission to Illyricum. We do, however, have clear and certain evidence that he established churches in areas between these two points. It cannot be stressed enough that Paul's mission was entirely to cities, at least so far as we know. That only makes sense. Paul clearly wanted to reach as many people as possible. Unlike Jesus, who preached in hamlets, villages, and remote areas of rural Galilee, Paul focused on urban centers, where populations were the most dense. His letters mention Christian communities in such places as Corinth, Philippi, Thessalonica, Colossae, Laodicea, Ephesus, and the region of Galatia. Among other things, this means he was traveling a lot. One scholar has pointed out that, in the book of Acts alone, Paul's journeys cover some 10,000 miles. That is not implausible. The Roman road system was extensive and well-maintained, and it was a time of virtual peace on the interior of the empire. Ancient ships could cover 100 miles a day, ordinary travelers on foot probably 15 or 20. On the whole, international travel was more popular and feasible in the Roman Empire than at any time in previous history, and more than in all the centuries to follow until the Industrial Revolution. It is difficult to discern a pattern in Paul's travels, but his general principle appears clear. Either alone or, more commonly, with Christian companions, he would come to a new city, make converts, start a worshiping community, and instruct the new members in the basics of the faith. When he judged the church could survive and thrive on its own, he would then move on to the next place. He thus established churches in major urban settings, one after the other, principally provincial capitals and Roman colonies, by converting Gentiles to believe in the God of the Jews and in Christ as his Son, who died for the sins of the world and was raised from the dead. Clearly, Paul seems to have understood himself to be planting churches, as he himself states in his letter to the Christians in Corinth. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. Once planted, the church would grow by accumulating new members. After Paul journeyed onward, he continued to be invested in the communal lives of the churches he left behind. That is demonstrated by the letters themselves as he responds to problems that have arisen in one community or another over what to believe and how to behave. He was not one to stay too long in one location. He had a gospel to preach, and he needed to take it where it had not yet been proclaimed. As he writes, "Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But how can they call upon one in whom they have not believed? And how can they believe if they have not heard? And how can they hear without one who preaches?" Romans chapter 10, verses 13 through 15. He was the preacher, the one who brought the word of faith. The ultimate goal of his mission was, in his words, that the full number of Gentiles would come into the faith. Romans chapter 11, verse 25. Paul saw himself as the one responsible for making it happen. We do not know his master strategy, given his inability to be everywhere at once. Possibly he planned to preach in one region and then the next, not in every city and town in the region, but in major urban centers, anticipating that the churches he planted would not just grow, but would also fertilize the areas around them, leading to new growths and more expansion. Were that to work, the entire region and eventually every entire region would be filled with believers in Jesus. When Paul wrote his letter to the Romans from the Greek city of Corinth, he indicated that he no longer had any room for work in these regions. Romans chapter 15, verse 23. He evidently meant in the entire eastern Mediterranean, since he then mentioned his plan to use Rome as a stopping point before moving on to preach in Spain. It appears that Rome was to be a base of operations from which to evangelize the Western Empire. Spain was as far west as he could go. Some scholars have plausibly argued that this was his ultimate objective. Recall that Isaiah had predicted the good news of God's salvation would be taken to the end of the earth, Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6, quoted by Paul in Acts chapter 13, verse 47. Was Spain the end of the earth? Paul may well have thought so, believing that once he established the church there, the last days would be near when the full number of the Gentiles had come in and all Israel would be saved. Romans chapter 11, verses 25 and 26. If so, this is heady stuff. In the words of one Pauline scholar, Paul himself had become the central figure in the story of salvation. Paul's modus operandi. It is difficult to know for certain how Paul conducted his mission on the ground. He was moving to cities that, so far as we can tell, he had never visited before, and trying to convert strangers to the faith. He apparently succeeded a good deal, but how did he do it? We should not think that Paul staged tent revivals like a traveling American evangelist in the 19th or 20th century. There is no reference to any such undertaking in his letters or even in Acts. The public speeches in Acts were almost always occasioned by a random and fortuitous event, such as a public miracle. They are not organized in advance. It is theoretically possible that Paul acted on a more ad hoc basis, entering a public space and preaching, as it were, from a soapbox. But that too seems unlikely, both because the success rate would surely be inordinately low, and because neither Acts nor Paul himself says anything of the sort. More plausibly, it has been suggested that Paul would attend the local synagogue during services on Sabbath, and use the occasion as a visitor in town to proclaim his good news about Jesus the Messiah. After making some converts, according to this scenario, Paul would then use the synagogue as a kind of base of operations to begin reaching pagans in the community. A strategy like this makes a good deal of sense. For someone new in town, the obvious first place to go would be where one could make contacts with people from similar backgrounds. And for a Jew who had just arrived, no better place would exist than one of the local synagogues. Moreover, as we saw at the outset of this chapter, Paul had been punished in synagogues, evidently flogged within an inch of his life on five separate occasions. Paul was no stranger to hostile Jewish environments, presumably in cities he was attempting to evangelize. On the other hand, it cannot be overemphasized that Paul sees himself as a missionary not to Jews but to Gentiles. In addition, it would have been very difficult to use a synagogue as a base of operations if everyone there, including the leaders who wielded the power and the whip, hated you and wanted to beat some good sense into you. Also, contrary to what one might think, there is little indeed to suggest that the communities of believers that Paul addressed comprised both Jews and Gentiles. When he refers to his converts' former religious lives, It is to their worship of pagan gods. As he reminds the Corinthians, "You know that when you were pagans, you were led astray by idols that could not speak." 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 2. So too, when he recalls to the Thessalonians that they used to worship dead idols. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9. The entire letter to the Galatians is predicated on the fact that the readers are Gentile Christians being told by false teachers to begin practicing the ways of Judaism. These are all churches filled with pagan converts. So where did Paul meet them? Modern scholarship has landed on a solution that is both sensible and supported by Paul's own words. In his letter to the Thessalonians, Paul recalls preaching while engaged in manual labor. "For you remember, brothers and sisters, our labor and toil. During night and day we labored so as not to burden you, preaching to you the gospel of God." 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9. When he refers to his toil here, it is not to his toil of preaching. It was toil that kept him from having to be supported financially by others. He was working both a day and a night job. So too, in his letter to the Corinthians, Paul stresses that he and his missionary companions engaged in a life of labor, working with our own hands. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 12. Later, he reminds them how he and his companion Barnabas had to work for a living. Chapter 9, verse 6. And so the question is, how are we to imagine the relationship between Paul's daily work and his missionary activity? New Testament scholar Ronald Hawk has argued the most persuasive case. Paul was preaching on the job. Support for this view comes from the book of Acts, which indicates that Paul was a professional tent maker. Acts chapter 18, verse 3. Some scholars have thought this word can have broader applicability, referring to some kind of leather goods work. Tents were made from animal skins, but so obviously were lots of other things. There is no certainty on the matter, but it does appear that Paul was a craftsman of some kind. If so, we can have a good idea of how he proceeded from one town to the next, establishing churches. If he was a leather worker, Paul would have had a mobile profession. He would have taken his knives, awls, and other tools of the trade with him from one place to the next. When coming to a new town, he would meet up with others in his line of work. Commonly, the professions were centered in one part of the city or another. He would choose an apt spot, rent out a space for his workshop, probably secure an apartment in a floor above for living quarters. This was common in city dwellings. A multi-level building of this sort was called an insula, and open up for business. It is in some such context that he would have preached night and day to the Thessalonians. People would come into his shop for business, and he would talk to them about religion. Businesses, as a rule, were far more casual in that way than today. People could spend a long time in conversation. Paul, by his own account, was at it at all hours. Obviously, he would not be able to convert someone the first time they met on the spot. He was urging pagan people to give up every religious tradition and cultic practice they had ever known. That took time. But he had time. He had to work. He was at it before dawn to after dusk. And while working with his hands, he was preaching the gospel. One can imagine that he was rarely successful. But it would not take a lot of success to make a big difference. For one thing, it was a common feature of ancient life for the head of a household, the senior adult male, to make the family's decisions when it came to religion. Convert the head of the household and you converted the entire family. Modern Christians might say that the wife and children of a convert should not really be counted as converts because it was not their choice. Even so, new religious traditions and forms of worship would be introduced into the household, and everyone in it would participate. In many or even most situations, over a period of months or years, other members of the family would surely come over, mentally and emotionally as well. Thus, one convert could translate into numerous others. One other factor to consider is the high population density of ancient cities. The modern city of Antakya in southeastern Turkey has just over 200,000 inhabitants, and by most modern standards is crowded. In Paul's day, it was called Antioch, and it had twice that population, but you could walk around its circumference in an afternoon. The average population density in Roman cities was about 200 persons per acre, matched today in only the densest inner cities. There was little space and even less privacy. One result was that news could spread very quickly indeed, and rumor and gossip. If someone adopted a completely new set of religious traditions, abandoning the traditions and worship that everyone else followed more or less without question, any such conversion would no doubt spark comment, curiosity, and interest. Maybe enough interest to see what it was all about. More people would start showing up in Paul's workshop. He would not convert the majority of them by any stretch of the imagination, but he would convert some. Heads of the household would then convert their families. The church would be planted and start to grow. Soon Paul would be satisfied that the planting season was finished, and he would head off to the next city to start all over again. This would go on for years, possibly for 3 decades. We will never know how many churches Paul started, but he is explicitly associated with about 12 in his writings. Possibly there were many more. We are still left with a question of what Paul would say to potential converts that would prove at all convincing. As we will see more fully in the next chapter, these people were pagans who worshipped numerous divine beings by local customs that had been handed down over the centuries and that everyone simply took for granted. Temples to pagan gods would be found everywhere throughout a major city, and in the temple would be idols, statues of the gods, that represented a kind of physical representation of the divinity itself. Outside the temple would be an altar on which to perform occasional sacrifices to the god, or rather to watch someone else do so. People could frequent as many temples of as many gods as they wanted. They would also worship their own family gods, and participate in worship of the emperor and of any of the gods that the Roman state itself promoted. In any city at any time, there was a rich, fertile, and extraordinarily textured set of cultic traditions. Paul's mission was to convert people from these pagan traditions to be believers in Jesus. What did he say, and how did he convince anyone? Paul's message. In his surviving letters, Paul never explicates the message he had delivered to his potential converts. Obviously, there was no reason for him to do so. He was writing about other matters precisely to the people he had converted, who knew full well what he had said at the time, presumably, over and over again. But he does on occasion make an elusive reference back to his preaching, and as scant as these recollections are, they provide an intriguing insight into what Paul said and the rhetorical strategy he used. We find the first such reference in the earliest of Paul's surviving writings, the letter of 1 Thessalonians. In fondly recalling the time he had spent with the Christians of Thessalonica in northern Greece, Paul has occasion to remember how they, as former pagans, came to join with him in his Christian faith, how they turned to God from idols, to serve the living and true God, and to await his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, the one who saves us from the wrath that is coming. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. The comment is terse but illuminating. To convert to the Christian faith through Paul's gospel was both more or less complicated than converting to Judaism. It was more complicated because it involved not simply coming to believe that the Jewish God was the only one who deserved to be worshipped, but also to believe that Jesus was his Son, who had been raised from the dead for salvation. Even in its briefest form, this is a 2-step conversion, faith in God and faith in Jesus, not 1 step. At the same time, these 2 steps were somewhat less complicated than converting to Judaism, since the convert was not then expected to join the Jewish people by adopting Jewish customs and following Jewish laws, including most notably circumcision, Sabbath observance, keeping Jewish festivals, and following kosher food laws. The first and undoubtedly most difficult step in converting pagans to Christianity was to convince them to turn away from the gods they had worshipped from infancy, gods that not just their immediate families, but also all their friends, neighbors, fellow citizens, and in fact, with the exception of Jews, everyone in their entire world worshipped. This would obviously be an enormous step. One would have to give up all the daily and periodic festivals, processions, sacrifices, prayers, beliefs, and practices attendant to all the traditional religions they had ever known. How did Paul manage to convince anyone to do it? He shows how he did it in this concise recollection of 1 Thessalonians. He convinced the pagans that their idols, the statues of their gods, were dead, and that they should instead worship the living God. For Paul, there was only God who was alive and active in the world. The others were completely dead and useless, inert and able to do nothing. It appears that when Paul preached to these pagans, he employed the standard kind of attack on pagan gods that had been used by Jews for centuries. One of our earliest examples of this kind of attack, which shows both its rhetorical strategy and force, is in the Hebrew Bible, in a passage that Paul, with his rigorous training in Judaism, must have known intimately. It is found in the book of Isaiah, where the prophet mocks the gods of the pagans. He points out that a person who makes a god statue, an idol, fashions it out of wood or iron, not realizing that this is all it is, wood or iron. It is not a god. It has no power. It can do nothing. It is human-designed and human-made. In his mockery, the prophet points out that after the woodworker cuts down a tree for the material he needs to fashion his god, then the wood can be used as fuel. Part of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Then he makes a god and worships it, makes a carved image and bows down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half he roasts meat, eats it, and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm, I can feel the fire." The rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, bows down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, "Save me, for you are my God." A deluded mind has led him astray, and he cannot save himself or say, "Is not this thing in my right hand a fraud?" Isaiah chapter 44, verses 15 through 17, verse 20. This kind of polemic would have seemed common sense to most Jews. Many pagans, it has to be admitted, would have found it either ridiculous or irrelevant for a very simple reason. Pagans, at least the reflective ones among them, did not consider their cult statues to be gods. They considered them to be representations of gods, visual aids, as it were, to help one focus on the reality of the god. Or in a somewhat more sophisticated vein, they thought the cult statue was a focal point of divine energy, the place through which the god could manifest its power. But the item itself was not a god. It was an image or a conduit for a god. Many pagans, on the other hand, may not have thought at this level of abstraction and may simply have taken the intellectual shortcut assumed by Jewish polemicists, thinking that idols really were gods. People like that would certainly be susceptible to the kind of critique leveled by Isaiah, by Jewish polemicists after his day, and by people like Paul, who in a different moment wanted to convince them that their own gods were lifeless, powerless, ineffectual, in short, dead. Paul almost certainly preached some version of this message, and he proclaimed by contrast the glories of the living God, the one who created the heavens and the earth, the one who saved his people Israel from their slavery in Egypt at the Exodus, the one who did miracles through his prophets, and who continued to do miracles among the living in Paul's own day. But Paul also had to persuade his listeners to believe in Christ. His message was not simply about the living God, but also about the living Jesus. In fact, Paul's message about the living Jesus may have itself been the medium through which he preached about the living God. The notion that God is living presupposes that God is active not just in heaven, but also on earth. A living God is a God who is involved in this world. He is a God who acts in ways that appear miraculous to mere mortals. In fact, his actions are miracles. Paul preached God's miracles as demonstrations of power available to all who believed, and he focused on one miracle in particular, as he himself indicates in the recollection I have quoted of his preaching to the Thessalonians. He preached that God had raised Jesus from the dead. Paul's message to these converts began with a historical fact. Jesus was a Jewish prophet who was crucified by the Romans. There would be nothing incredible about that. Romans were crucifying people all the time. What makes this one instance stand out is what happened afterward. God raised Jesus from the dead. This is the heart and soul of Paul's proclamation. It is one that he could speak with enormous conviction, the kind of conviction that could win converts. Paul knew that God raised Jesus from the dead because he himself had seen Jesus alive afterward. Paul could swear to it. He did swear to it. Moreover, he was a reasonable, intelligent, clear-thinking human being. We can assume that he seemed completely honest and ingenuous. He would have been straightforward and emphatic. With his own eyes, he had seen the crucified Jesus alive again. This must have been convincing to people, at least some people. Paul's potential converts must have wondered why God would allow his son to die. especially a death by crucifixion, the most torturous, horrific, and feared form of execution in Roman antiquity. So, Paul's next step was to explain what the death of Jesus meant. We know how Paul explained Jesus' death because of another recollection of his missionary preaching in a different letter. This one, not to the Thessalonians, but to the Church of Corinth, farther south along the eastern coast of Greece. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians is much longer and involved than the one to the Thessalonians. In it, he deals with a large number of problems that the Corinthian church was experiencing. Near the end, Paul has occasion to recall what he had preached to them. They, too, had been pagans when first he converted them, a message that Paul indicates he had received. "For I delivered over to you among the most important things what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. And last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me." 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 5, and verse 8. This was the core of Paul's missionary message. As he himself says, Christ's death was not a miscarriage of justice or a tragic accident of history. It was all part of God's plan of salvation that had earlier been set forth in the Jewish Scriptures. Jesus died for our sins. In this message, Paul stressed there could be no doubt about Jesus' death because after he died, he was buried. But Jesus did not stay dead. God raised him from the dead again in fulfillment of the Scriptures. Once more, there could be no doubt because he then appeared on several occasions to his disciples. Last of all, he appeared to Paul. Paul saw him. He really was raised. If he was raised, God must have raised him. If God raised him, his death must have been by divine design. It was a death God planned and willed because it was a death for the sake of the sins of others. It is the death and resurrection of Jesus that put a person in a right standing before the one and only God, a living God, who has done miracles in this world that he created. But Paul's message did not end there. Recall from the passage in 1 Thessalonians that Paul reminded the Thessalonian Christians not only about what happened in their past, how they turned from their dead idols to the living God, but also about what was about to happen in their future. They turned to God, and they now await his Son from heaven, Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath that is coming. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 10. The second coming of Jesus was absolutely central to Paul's preaching. It was not simply an afterthought. It was, in fact, a natural corollary to the declaration that Jesus had been raised. If he had been raised, where was he? Why wasn't he anywhere to be seen? Paul maintained that Jesus was no longer present because he had been taken up to heaven and given a position of divine glory. But he would not reside there forever. God's act of salvation was much, much larger than simply saving a few souls here and there. God's plan was to redeem the entire world. It is crucial to remember that even before his conversion, Paul was a thoroughgoing apocalypticist. He did not abandon his apocalyptic thinking when he came to follow Jesus. His apocalypticism was instead brought into his new faith and formed his framework for understanding it. This world was controlled by evil forces. That was why there was so much pain and misery here. But God was ultimately sovereign and was about to reestablish his control over the world. He was soon to enter into judgment and overthrow the forces of evil, along with everyone who sided with him, in order to bring about his good kingdom here on earth. The utopia to come was to be preceded by a cataclysmic act of destruction. God's wrath was about to strike. God would send a cosmic judge of the earth to destroy his enemies and set up his kingdom. And for Paul, that cosmic judge was Jesus. It was Jesus whom the Thessalonians were to await from heaven, because he was the one who would save us from the wrath that is coming. Paul's message, in a nutshell, was a Jewish apocalyptic proclamation with a seriously Christian twist. God was saving this world. He had destroyed the power of sin by the death of Jesus. He had destroyed the power of death by the resurrection of Jesus. And he would destroy the power of evil by the return of Jesus. It was all going according to plan. Paul knew for a fact that it was because, with his own eyes, he had seen that Jesus had been raised from the dead. He also knew that Jesus was soon to return. This time, he would not come meekly. Paul's mode of persuasion. It is not hard to see how Paul might convert at least some pagans with this message, given his confidence and self-assurance as one who had personally seen the resurrected Jesus. But was there anything else that made his message particularly persuasive? Here we have to rely on scant but tantalizing allusions that no doubt resonated clearly with the audience of Paul's letters, who knew full well what he was talking about, but whose meaning can only be surmised by those of us living 2 millennia later. In a later chapter, we will see that Christian sources of the first 4 centuries consistently report one and virtually only one thing that convinced people to convert to the faith. They saw, or more often heard about, miracles that authenticated the Christian message. Miracles led to faith. Let me be clear that I'm not saying that Christian missionaries were actually performing the miraculous works ascribed to them in our sources. Healing the sick, speaking with demons and driving them out, raising the dead, leveling pagan places of worship with a word, giving dogs human voices and bringing smoked tuna back to life. We will see these miracles later. I do not think there is any way, given the nature of the historical discipline and the tools in the historian's chest, for a historian ever to claim that any of these things probably happened. Believers may think they did, non-believers will think they did not, and historians cannot arbitrate in that dispute, although theologians may want to give it a go. What historians can say, clearly, empathetically, and with a clear conscience, is that throughout history people have thought miracles happened. Most often they have thought this not because they saw miracles, but because they heard about them. Paul's converts heard about miracles. In fact, he suggests they saw him personally do miracles, or thought they saw him do them, which for our purpose comes to the same thing. Again, the references are elusive at best, but they do seem to point in that direction. In Paul's letter to the Romans, where he indicates he had preached the gospel throughout the eastern Mediterranean, from Jerusalem to Illyricum, he claims he converted people not only by word, but also by deed, by the power of signs and wonders, by the power of the Holy Spirit, Romans chapter 15, verses 18 and 19. It is hard to imagine what signs, wonders, and the Spirit power would be if not miracles. So too, in his first letter to the Corinthians, Paul admits his speaking abilities were rather feeble, but his words were backed up by incredible acts. I was with you in weakness and fear and great trembling, and my word and preaching was not in persuasive words of wisdom, but also in a show of the Spirit and of power. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Again, Spirit and power as a supplement to his preaching. Then, more emphatically, in his second letter to the Corinthians, while reminding his readers of his apostolic ministry among them, Paul states that the signs of an apostle were performed among you in all patience, signs and wonders and miracles. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 12. What was Paul actually doing in these people's presence? We have no reliable record and no real clue. Whatever it was, it must have been stupendous, and it proved convincing. He was, after all, converting people and establishing churches in city after city. Paul in sum. I am all too aware of the problem of hyperbole, but I nonetheless stick to my claim. Paul was not simply the most significant convert of the first few years of Christianity, or of the first century, or of the early church. He was the most significant Christian convert of all time. One can argue that without Paul, Christian history as we know it would not have happened. It is not that Paul himself started Christianity. Christians were already around before his time. Otherwise, he would not have had anyone to persecute. Moreover, contrary to what people often say, it is not that Paul invented the idea that Jesus' death and resurrection brought salvation. That is what the earliest Christians were proclaiming before Paul had ever heard of them. Instead, Paul is so significant because he came to believe, whether in a flash as claimed in the New Testament, or over a period of time as calmer reflection might suggest, that the death and resurrection of Jesus brought a salvation that was not tied to explicit Jewish identity. That the salvation of Christ was efficacious for Gentiles as well as Jews. That pagans who came to believe in Christ did not first have to convert to Judaism and begin to follow the prescriptions of Jewish law and custom. Salvation had indeed come to the Jews, but it had gone forth to the Gentiles. God was in the process of saving the entire world. Gentiles could remain Gentiles, and presumably Jews could remain Jews. What is more, Paul believed God had called him, and him in particular, to make this gospel, this good news, known to the world at large. The prophets of old had predicted someone would come to bring light to the Gentiles, enlightenment to the pagans. Paul was that one. He had a message and a mission, and it was not a small-time affair merely involving a leather worker talking to customers in his shop. It was that, but it was also massively bigger. It was a fulfillment of the promises God had made through his prophets centuries earlier. Paul's mission would bring God's entire plan of salvation to completion. Once Paul had reached the ends of the earth, the Gentiles would have heard the message and the climax of history could arrive. Jesus would come from heaven, the forces of evil would be destroyed, and God's utopian kingdom would arrive. Paul's mission was of cosmic proportions. The end, of course, did not come, but the Christian message continued to thrive after Paul's day. It does not appear to have thrived in Jewish circles. Nearly all the early Christians we know about, including those addressed in our earliest writings, those of the New Testament, came from pagan stock. For reasons I have set forth in this chapter, most Jews simply could not accept the claim that Jesus, a lower-class itinerant preacher who was crucified for crimes against the state, was in fact God's Messiah. Pagans proved more receptive to the message, not just in Paul's day, but in the decades and centuries to come. Later we will consider how the message was preached after Paul and why it succeeded. First, we need to gain an even clearer idea of what it was pagan converts were converting from. That will require us to explore more fully the world of Roman paganism, the world from which most Christians came, and that they then confronted. Chapter 3. The Religious World of Conversion. Roman Paganism. The earliest Christians were Jews. According to the New Testament, the first to believe in Jesus' resurrection were his 11 disciples, Judas Iscariot no longer being on the scene, and a handful of women, including Mary Magdalene. See Matthew chapter 28, Luke chapter 21, John chapter 21. They were all from rural Galilee, the northern part of the land of Israel. One of the Gospels, Matthew, indicates that the disciples came to this belief, although some doubted, sometime after Jesus' execution, when they had returned to Galilee, Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 and 17. That seems reasonable. They had made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem with Jesus to celebrate a Passover festival. Things had not gone well there, and Jesus had been arrested, tried, and crucified for crimes against the state. It seems unlikely the others would have stayed in the city to see if the authorities would come for them next. They went back home, possibly in some haste. Once these followers came to believe, they presumably told others in Galilee that Jesus had been raised, and these people converted. Eventually, when the heat died down, some of the disciples, if not all, returned to Jerusalem. We are not sure why. Did they already at this early date expect Jesus to return there? Whatever their reasons, we find them in Jerusalem, in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1. And that's where Paul locates them as well, Galatians chapter 1. It appears the city became the base of the Christian operation with Jesus' disciple Peter and then his brother James, taking charge of the small but growing community. That community would have principally comprised locals in the capital, that is, all Jews. Paul indicates that the earliest believers had undertaken a mission to convert Jews to the faith headed by Peter, Galatians chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. That too is completely plausible. It is usually assumed, then, that the first Christian community was located in the principal city of Judea. We do not learn much about the group in later sources, apart from the names of their leaders and a scant few legends associated with them. The truth is that, for reasons we saw in the previous chapter, the Jewish mission was never a huge success. In sources over the next four centuries, we occasionally learn of a Jewish group of Christians here or there in the empire, in the Transjordan in Egypt, but they never played a huge role in the ongoing life of the church at large. They were almost always on the margins. The Jewish Christians were probably heading to the margins by the second part of the first century. We have seen that Paul himself was intent on establishing communities of believers on pagan soil, and he is the only massively effective evangelist we hear of in our first century sources. His churches, which appear to have grown even after he relocated to evangelize elsewhere, comprised exclusively or almost exclusively pagan converts. And not just the churches he founded. The one surviving letter from his pen sent to a community he did not start is to the Christians in the city of Rome, a church he had yet to visit. He explicitly addresses the Christians there as Gentiles, Romans chapter 1, verse 13, chapter 11, verse 13. Scholars frequently argue that it was a strongly mixed church of Jew and Gentile. It may have been that, but the letter itself indicates that the vast majority of the congregation were converts from paganism. In the greetings in the final chapter, Paul names 26 people, several of whom indeed may have been Jewish. We can't tell just from their names. But he identifies six of them specifically as of my race, that is, Jews, Romans chapter 16, verse 7, 11, and 21. That this is an identity marker of just these six seems to suggest that they stood out for reason of their heritage from all the rest. The other 20 were probably former pagans. Much the same can be said about the churches addressed by most of our earliest Christian writings. The vast majority of the New Testament books, including that most Jewish of our Gospels, Matthew, appear to be directed largely, if not exclusively, to Gentile audiences, and most may well have been written by Gentile authors. The church by the second half of the first century was probably made up of predominantly pagan stock. We have already seen some indications of who such people were and what they believed in connection with Constantine, the most famous and significant pagan convert in the history of Christendom. We can now explore the matter in greater depth, as a prelude to showing in the chapters that follow how Jesus' followers managed to convince so many of these pagans to abandon their ancestral religious traditions in order to worship the Christian God alone. The Ism in Paganism. Paganism, scholars have long argued, was not a single thing. Or to put the matter differently, there was no such thing as paganism. What we call paganism was numerous things. The word itself would have made no sense to ancient people, including the very ones we call pagans. No one called themselves or thought of themselves religiously as a pagan, not because it was a derogatory term, but because it was not a term with any religious meaning. The idea that all the hundreds or even thousands of ways of honoring the gods involved some kind of unified system was simply not part of the ancient intellectual landscape. The religious designation pagan came into existence only after customs for acknowledging and worshiping the gods had been in place for millennia. It was deployed by Christians in its religious sense as a way of referring to others who did not follow their own practices of religious observation. Christians had to call non-Christians something. Worshippers of the God of Israel were no problem. They could be called Jews. But what of everyone else? What of the 93% of the rest of the human race? There are different theories about why Christians settled on the term pagan to describe the non-Jewish other. Most commonly, it is thought that the word derives from the Latin term paganus, which refers to a person who resides in the countryside. The idea in this case is that as the empire became Christianized in the 4th century and later, the sophisticated city folk were more likely to see the clear superiority of the Christian faith. Only country bumpkins, the pagani, continued to observe the backward customs of their ignorant ancestors. Other scholars have argued instead that the term pagan originally referred to civilian as opposed to soldier. In that case, it would stand in contrast to the few, the strong, the brave, the soldiers of Christ. Those who were not in Christ's army were weak and morally out of shape. Whatever the origins of the term, pagan was not a self-identity marker. In the early Christian centuries, no one in the Roman world would say, "I am not a Jew, I am a pagan." Being not a Jew, or later not a Christian, simply meant being what everyone else was, a person who accepted the existence of gods and worshipped them by following customs that had been followed since time immemorial. There were innumerable such localized customs. Modern people might call each of them a religion. As we have seen, ancient people would not call them that since there was also no word for religion. And in fact, what we typically think today about religion simply did not apply to ancient modes of worship. If we were to define a religion as a coherent system of thought, belief, and practice, with a clearly demarcated set of theological views about the divine beings, and a prescribed set of rituals to be practiced in reference to them, then none of the so-called pagan religions would probably qualify. Certainly, the totality of all the customs followed over the expanse of the Roman Empire cannot be lumped together into a unified whole and considered a solitary religion. In Roman paganism, I will keep using the word for the sake of convenience, there were no set gods. Because the standard Greek and Roman mythologies are generally known, people today often still imagine there was just one ancient pantheon, for example, with Jupiter, the head god, Juno, his wife, Mars, the god of war, Venus, the goddess of love, and so on. It is true these gods were widely worshipped in the empire, but there was no set pantheon. Instead, there were different gods and various ways to worship them, depending on whether a person lived in North Africa, Egypt, Syria, Asia Minor, Greece, Gaul, Spain, Britain, or anywhere else. As a result, there was no universal mythology. Moreover, there was no single way to talk about the gods. There was no sense of a community of worshippers throughout the empire to which one would belong. There were no organizations with empire-wide oversight over religious practices, no religious authorities who transcended particular localities. Trying to wrap our minds around this totality is difficult. Religion and myth. It is often thought by people casually acquainted with the ancient world that Roman religion, and Greek religion as well, was focused on the famous myths that we still read today, that books such as Homer's Iliad and Odyssey functioned as the pagan Bible. The logic behind this view is that these literary works, along with writings of Hesiod and Euripides on the Greek side, or Virgil and Ovid on the Roman, reveal what people believed about the gods. The pagan myths seem comparable to the stories found in the Christian Bible, whether in the Old Testament with God's interactions with Israel, or in the New Testament with the stories of Jesus. Since religion involves principally how we think about God or the gods, in this view, the myths tell us what ancient religion was like. That common sense would not have made sense to most ancient Romans. It is true that myths were very important for helping people think about the gods. But ancient religion was less about what one thought and more about what one did. Traditional myths played a little part in most ancient religious customs. Stories about the gods and great works of literature were usually taken to be just that, great stories. The educated classes in particular insisted they were not to be taken literally. Myths were not so much accounts of what happened in the past as amusing and always entertaining tales or possibly highly allegorical narratives. As such, the myths formed the basis for a good bit of ancient literature, theater, and art, but they were not the theological basis for ancient religion, the equivalent of the Jewish scriptures or the New Testament writings. Pagan religions were almost entirely about practice, about doing things, about giving the gods their due, not through mental affirmations of who they were or what they had done, but through ritual actions that showed reverence and devotion. Religion then and now. In trying to conceptualize Roman pagan religions, one of the most important points to stress is that they differed enormously from how we think of religion today, at least in the context of the great monotheistic traditions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Many gods instead of one god. To begin with, Roman religions were all polytheistic, accepting the existence of many gods and promoting their worship. As just mentioned, there were Romans, certainly at least among the highly educated, who did come to believe that one ultimate divine being ruled over all. But these were the exception to the rule, and even they acknowledged the existence of numerous other divinities that varied in grandeur, power, and function. Many Romans did acknowledge a pantheon of the great gods known from the famous mythical tales, Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Venus, Minerva, Pluto, and the rest. But this was not the full extent of the divine realm. On the contrary, there were gods for every municipality and every family, gods with all sorts of functions, gods connected with love, war, livestock, crops, health, childbirth, and weather, gods associated with specific locations, mountains, streams, meadows, homes, hearths, gods of various abstractions such as fortune, mercy, and hope, gods connected with elements of nature, like the moon, the sun, the sky, and the sea. Less grand and powerful divinities existed as well, including those known collectively in Greek-speaking areas as daemons. These were not demons in the later Christian sense of fallen angels that inhabit human bodies and force them to do unpleasant things. They were low-level divine beings who were more active in humans' daily lives than the greater gods and who could be either nefarious or beneficent, depending on circumstances and their character or mood. How many gods were there? They could not be counted. There were many divine beings in many places, and the same god could be in many different places. A god such as the Greek Zeus was worshipped in cities hundreds of miles apart, in different ways, and with different appellatives. Zeus Kasios, Zeus Emon, Zeus Benios. In any city there would be temples to a wide array of gods. The Roman architect Vitruvius recommended that a Roman city have temples to the gods of the Roman capital, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, as well as to Mercury, Isis, and Serapis, Apollo, Liber Pater, Hercules, Mars, Venus, Vulcan, and Ceres. That was just a start. As one modern scholar has pointed out, we have coins from the city of Nicomedia, northeast Turkey, that advertise the worship of 40 deities there. Those are just the ones mentioned on the city's surviving coins. Polytheism in Roman antiquity was normally an open and welcoming affair. New gods could be added and worshipped at will. It was simply accepted that people would worship the gods they chose, gods supporting the state, gods of the municipality, gods of various functions, gods of various locations, gods of the family. The gods themselves were at peace, which is one way in which Roman religion was at odds with Roman mythology, where the gods were constantly at one another's throats. Moreover, the god worshipped in one locality was often identified with a different god called by a different name worshipped in another locality. Romans would frequently assimilate the gods of the people they conquered. This shows the remarkable openness of religious perspectives, and it made it possible for conquered people to continue living their lives with less cultural disruption. It also had the effect of submerging the identities of the other gods into the Roman system, just as the conquered people were also brought into a new form of governance and control. Because of the open nature of polytheism, there was virtually no such thing as conversion. Anyone who chose to begin worshipping a new god was welcome to do so, and was not required or expected to leave behind any previous practices of worship or make an exclusive commitment to this one deity. Outside the world of Judaism, exclusivity, the insistence that only one god be worshipped, was practically unknown. Many people today wonder what might have happened if Christianity had not eventually taken over the empire. Could another religion have done so? Some have argued that the mystery religion called Mithraism, discussed more later in the chapter, was Christianity's competition, that if the world had not become Christian, it might have become Mithraist. That is an intriguing idea, but on closer reflection it simply cannot be right. No one who started worshipping the god Mithras was required to stop worshipping Jupiter, Minerva, or Apollo. Mithraism may have spread, but it could not have destroyed anything to become the one and only option. At the same time, as we have seen, there were increasing numbers of pagan henotheists in the Roman world who maintained that situated above this mass of divine beings and the cults that honored them was one ultimate divinity. We observed an example already in chapter 1 with Constantine, who, prior to his Christian conversion, committed to the worship of Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun. Such a move would not have seemed a complete oddity in his world. Those who did acknowledge one ultimate divinity and chose to focus worship on that one alone, however, were not expected to deny either that other divine beings existed or that people were justified in worshipping them. Pagans who tended toward henotheism did so for a variety of reasons. Sometimes out of awe and wonder, a pagan worshiper would lavish such abundant praise on a particular god for being so incredibly powerful, wise, caring, merciful, just, and so on, that there would be nothing left to attribute to any other god. So why not simply worship this one? Sometimes these various attributes would be converted into names or epithets for the divinity. He is the greatest, most magnificent, healer of all. To the same effect, there was no need then to name any other god. Possibly more frequently, the hierarchy of power thought to exist among the various gods was taken to its logical extreme. The gods worshipped in large city festivals were greater than the daemons a farmer had to appease for the well-being of the crops. So too, the great gods of the Roman pantheon residing on Mount Olympus were greater than the gods distinctive to individual cities. This pyramid of power could be imagined as going all the way to the top, above the great gods of state, to one who was the most glorious and powerful. There cannot, of course, be two or more gods who are most glorious and powerful,